Tonight on Banfield, 2 weeks and still no arrests in the Idaho quadruple murder case. Classes are back in session after Thanksgiving break, minus a whole lot of students who won't come back until the slasher is caught. Also tonight, everything we thought we knew about the murder weapon may in fact be wrong. And that could point the investigation in a completely different direction. There are experts in what a blade can tell you about a murder, and I'm going to sound them out tonight. And then, the case of the butchered coyotes and the search for a link to the quadruple murders five years later. Were grisly pranks at the University of Idaho just that? Grisly pranks, or were they a bloody warning sign that should not have been ignored? And later, in the absence of answers, all of us have questions, and we want to answer yours as best we can. Our Brian Enten is live on the story, taking your questions tonight, and it's all straight ahead in a special hour of Banfield. Hello and welcome to this edition of Banfield. 2 weeks and a day since four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death while they slept. Police are tonight searching through the victims' vehicles again. The kids' cars have remained parked outside that crime scene since the night they all died inside that now infamous house off campus. Officers were seen retrieving the keys from inside the home. Again tonight, opening up car doors and looking for evidence. Any evidence. That's what it looks like 15 days later. Any evidence, because this many days later, it appears they may just be stumped as to who the maniacal killer is. And with that, madman still on the loose tonight. Police in the town of Moscow are not only caught up in their biggest investigation ever, they are facing a surge in calls for help. They describe the calls as, quote, unusual circumstances and requests to come and check on loved ones. Just since the murders, they've done twice as many so-called welfare checks as they did in the whole month of October. Classes resume today on campus, but with only 2 weeks until Christmas break, many students are afraid to return. And parents are afraid to send their kids back. Faculty is planning for both in-person and remote learning throughout the end of the entire school year. As for the quadruple murder investigation, there's now been a change to the timeline of the victims last night alive. Police now updating that Maddie Mogan and Kaylee Gonsalves returned home 11 minutes later than originally thought, at 1:56 a.m., not 1:45 a.m. The police say this is based on new, quote, digital evidence, but they're not telling us exactly what kind of digital evidence and who sent it in and what it looked like. We do know that every piece of the puzzle matters. And that brings me to News Nation's senior national correspondent, Brian Enten, who is live in Moscow tonight. So, Brian, there are just so many questions. And looking through the cars tonight just had me wondering. I assumed that part was done by day 15 or night 15. But you watched as they went through. How many cars did they go through? Did they collect anything into envelopes? Did they take anything away for analysis?
I saw them go into two cars, Ashley, and you're right. I mean, we're now 2 weeks out, and the fact that this is still an active crime scene behind me, they've got the crime scene tape up, they've got a Moscow police officer out here 24/7 making sure no one goes in. And my thought today was, okay, they're sort of just keeping things the way they are in case they need to go back in and analyze something. But no, today we saw a detective show up, go right in the front door right there. You can see there's still the red evidence markers on the door. He went in the front door. He turned right to the left. He got some keys off of a table. Then he came out. He tried to get into this white Chevy sedan that is out front of the house here, didn't get into it, but then went over to this red Jeep Wrangler, opened the side door. I tried to get over quickly to get a shot. Couldn't tell exactly what he got out of the car, but it seemed like he got something out, and then he went back into the house, Ashley.
One thing I'd like to ask you, I don't know if you're working with Luis tonight on the camera, but I just noticed behind you that the second bedroom lights are on tonight. That's different than most nights that we see the house. So if he could just sort of zero in on the bedroom on the right-hand side, because it looks to me like that might be open. Like, at least we could see through a little bit more than we've been able to see before. At least there's something in the window behind those shades.
Yeah, is that the one you're talking about? Is that the one?
That is.
Yeah, the lights are on there, Ashley. And then on the other side, too, if we move this way a little bit, you can see the lights. They've been on last night, too. There's actually some Christmas lights in the other room, too. And we'll walk around in a minute with you. But there's actually a lot of lights on in the house at night.
So it's fascinating. The room on the left, that's the living room where the kids would hang out, and that's where they had their Christmas lights. And those Christmas lights remained on for days and days, and then were out. They were actually turned out eventually. And then the room on the right, just by sort of triangulating all the photographs from the Zillow listings, the social media of the kids, and the reports from the police that there were bodies on both the second and third floors, the room on the right is more than likely where Zanna Kernodle had her bedroom, and perhaps she and Ethan Chapin were sleeping, because it is assumed they were likely sleeping together since it was so late at night. That's her boyfriend. He was staying over the night. It's also that bedroom out the back wall. So just go straight through that window and right to the back of the wall. That below that back wall is where the blood was seen dripping outside the house. So it's possible that with two victims, there might have been that much blood in that bedroom, so as to effectuate that it actually got through to the foundation. I do want to ask you about this. This is the first night, Brian, where I am watching a reporter standing out front in deep snow. And I saw it snowing all day. Up until now, we've been seeing evidence collection going on actually, you know, on the ground, picking through the grass, looking for things, looking in the parking lot, looking for tire prints. None of that seems to be happening now, and it certainly would seem that the snow would hamper that.
Yeah, I mean, the weather situation changed totally out here. We've had crews out here for the last couple of weeks. You've been covering it extensively. It's been dry for the most part. Today, it just dumped snow all day long, multiple inches. So this entire yard, the driveway, all of it is covered up. I mean, if there are footprints that they were still looking for or any sort of blood spatter, I mean, you can see now snow everywhere. So let's hope that that part of the investigation, they've documented everything they need, because the conditions out here have just changed drastically at this point, Ashley.
You can see that obviously those flowers and mementos were left fairly recently, as they don't have snow piled on top of them. So this timeline change was pretty fascinating, Brian. That just breaks my heart to see this. That's obviously, you know, kids perhaps coming back from break and then leaving those mementos there. But the timeline change. 11 minutes may not seem like a big deal to people, but in a murder investigation, it can be the linchpin. It can be everything. The supposition here is that it is digital evidence, photographs, video, maybe somebody sent in some social media to the police, and they were able to determine, to the point where they could announce it publicly, that those girls arrived home at 11:56. So the question I have for you is, that would let us have some idea that there is proof of them arriving there, which would tell me that it's possible there might be proof of someone else arriving on camera there later, a killer. Is anyone discussing that within the investigative ranks?
So they're not talking about it. I mean, it's obviously a lot that they're not saying that they likely know or that they have ideas about. There's been a lot of talk about surveillance video, ring cameras in this area that may have caught the girls coming home or caught perhaps the suspect coming here. I'll tell you, I spent most of the day looking for ring cameras in this area. We couldn't come up with any. There are a couple here. None of them face the house. And the ones that are in the vicinity were actually people who are super freaked out by what happened, who got the cameras after the fact because they're now scared being here. So we don't know exactly what digital evidence caused them to change the timeline, but there's clearly something they have now that made them alter things.
Also makes me wonder if they've just spent, you know, days and days going through all of the apps on the girls' phones, maybe their Apple Watches, which might give an indicator of a popcorn trail. Listen, I track my kids. I have a locator when my kids are moving about, and I can see where they are at certain times. So perhaps those girls had that as well. Maybe their parents had started them young with that app, and it might still be on their phones. Okay, another question I wanted to ask you about, and that is a piece of information that came up today that really tweaked my interest. It may be nothing, Brian. It may be everything. Two of the sororities on campus are currently on disciplinary probation. It's apparently about health and welfare, which could be drinking excessively. It could be, you know, I don't know, violations of mold in the house, so who knows. But two sororities are on disciplinary probation, including the Pi Beta Phi. And the Pi Beta Phi, as you can see on the bottom, is the sorority where three of the girls in that house belonged. Maddie Mogan, who died, Zena Kernodle, who died, and Bethany Funk, who survived. It's just curious that three of the victims belong to this one particular sorority that showed up on this list today.
It is, and it certainly piqued our interest, too, and our team has been trying to get to the bottom of it. We were able to confirm, you mentioned, the suspensions and that there's been issues with these sororities, but in terms of the details, we haven't been getting any responses. We reached out to the sororities, we reached out to the university, no response so far. I can tell you, interesting, being here on the ground now, there are a lot of sororities and fraternities here. This is a school where a lot of people are in Greek life. They're all over the place here. But why those two sororities got in trouble, again, we know for sure they were in trouble. The details behind it, they're still not releasing.
So we reported off the top that the police have said there's this huge surge in phone calls, really unusual kinds of phone calls that they're getting. They're not just getting, I'm scared, I heard a noise. What sort of things are they hearing about that, you know, stand out?
Look, there's 70 plus calls over the last 2 weeks, people who are just freaked out. I mean, people are scared here. I can't emphasize it enough. Walking around campus today, people are on edge. They're on alert. Students were nervous to come back. I mean, they feel like there is a killer in their community. So some of these calls are, you know, things like weird lights shining in my windows. There were a few kind of really eerie things. People's front doors were open and they didn't open them and they came downstairs and the door was open. Things that they were reporting like that. Did any of these things actually pan out to be legitimate police investigations? No, but I think it just paints the picture of how this is really a town that is fully on edge, nervous, amped up, really wanting some kind of resolution to all of this.
If my door was open and I didn't leave it open, in this circumstance, you're damn right, I'd be calling 911 and I'd say, hurry. Brian, one of the things I was really fascinated by was your walk around the crime scene today, but your walk around campus as well to really get a feel now that everybody's back. I want to take a quick look. Take a peek.
Classes are back in session at the University of Idaho, but it is noticeably quieter. Many students opting not to return to campus since the killer who stabbed students Ethan Chapin, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Kaylee Gonzalez is still on the run.
I feel like a lot of people are pretty apprehensive and everybody's being very vigilant, just kind of like avoiding bars and like downtown areas and things like that, you know, walking with a buddy and like that type of thing.
Local and state police have beefed up their presence on campus, and sorority houses have hired private security guards.
I personally won't go out at night alone right now, but I do feel like there is like increased police on campus.
Does it feel less busy on campus today?
Yeah, actually it does. It seems a little less people walking around. For sure.
It's unclear what neighbors near the house where the murders happened have told police or if police have suspect information that they are not sharing with the public. Investigators acknowledge the sense of fear in the small community and say since the murders, they've received 78 calls for unusual circumstances. Everything from a caller telling police her front door was wide open, another reporting someone shining a light into her window, a window tagged in red spray paint, men shadowboxing people getting close and touching them in a bar, and a woman receiving a note saying she better watch out. It's been a little more than 2 weeks now since the murders. Parts of the timeline are still missing, but we know according to police that Kaylee and Madison were here the night before the killings at a bar called the Corner Club in Moscow. Investigators say they were here between 10 p.m. and 1:30 a.m. The bartender inside the club told me workers were instructed only to talk to police. At 1:40 a.m., Kaylee and Madison were seen on surveillance video at the grub truck just down the street. Police say they used a private party for a ride back home, arriving back here at the house at about 1:56 a.m. Investigators say the other victims, Ethan and Zana, were seen here at the Sigma Chi fraternity. They returned back to the house around 1:45 a.m., the killings happening soon after. And now, more than 2 weeks later, so much fear and angst that an arrest has not been made.
This could be anybody.
It could be anybody. It really could.
I mean, you know,
you never
everybody
really
knows
know.
Somebody is cracked at one time or another.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
It's just so brutal, though. I mean,
yeah. That's the thing. That's the thing. That's
very personal, too, if you like.
And, you know, I think the biggest concern out here, Ashley, and the thing that we keep hearing over and over again from people all over this community is they want to know, do police have information that they're not sharing? Are they close to making an arrest? Are there things that they have behind the scenes that show that this investigation is moving along? Or do they not have anything? And that's why they continue to ask the public for tips. They really want to know.
I'll tell you what, I am fascinated to see that the work continues late at night with that window lit up behind you. By the way, let us know if you see any movement in those windows, because we can point out exactly whose room they're investigating, you know, at each point, what we believe to be, you know, which room. And obviously on the upper floors, it was Kaylee's room on the right as you're looking at the house, and it was Maddie's room on the left. So if you see those windows on the third floor, but that window on the right-hand side is the first time I've really seen it lit up at night, and seen that whatever that pattern is of what's sitting in the window. But if you see people moving inside, Brian, definitely let us know. As I said, I believe that to be Zena Kernodle's room, where she and Ethan would have been sleeping that night on the second floor. And of course, over on the left is the living room. Brian, stand by for 1 second. Don't go anywhere. I actually want to add somebody to our conversation, Lauren Patterson. She is a reporter for Northwest Public Broadcasting and Spokane Public Radio. She's also a resident of Moscow. Thank you, Lauren, for coming back to the program. One thing I didn't know when we first met you last week and we're talking about this case, Lauren, was that your husband is an instructor at the University of Idaho, and Kaylee Gonsalves was one of his kids, one of his students. Can you tell me anything about his interactions with her?
Yes, from what he's told me, my husband said Kaylee was a very achievement-oriented student. She was always working to get the best grades. He also said she had a lot of friends in the class, which I think speaks to her wide social circle.
That makes sense. When I look at her Instagram, it's loaded with fun and friends. Not to say everybody's isn't, but hers in particular just seems to be so filled with joy and so many, you know, friends and associates, close friends, you know, that you would snuggle with in pictures. So the other question I wanted to ask of you, because you're there and you live there and you would know the difference between, you know, D-Day before this began and then after, is that the local businesses, they really rely on a lot of kids as their employees. And many of these kids have not come back. So what is the net effect of that, Lauren?
You're right, Ashley. The Vandal students, they're a big part of the Moscow workforce. I was just speaking with the campus rec center manager today, the on-campus gym, and he said he's lost about a third of his workforce to students going home early. So the gym availability, along with some other buildings on campus, and maybe even local businesses, might be a little tenuous depending on how many students have left the area.
That's hard. I mean, that's going to be a big effect for the people who live there, losing that many kids. Who knows if they'll even come back after the Christmas break, too, however long this goes on. Brian, as you were flying to Idaho, I understand that you sat beside a very nervous mother who had something to say about the sorority houses on campus and what's happening there. Can you walk me through the conversation you had with her?
Yeah, she was nervous. Her daughter, who was also on the flight, is in one of the sororities, knows some of these girls. And you know, she was allowing her daughter to come back to campus because her daughter wanted to be at the vigil so badly. But so many parents are not making that choice. One thing that made her feel better is that her sorority hired private security, multiple private security, some former military, to be at the sorority house 24 hours a day. That made her feel better. Walking around campus today, I'll tell you, most of the people were walking in groups, at least in pairs. There are people who live off campus that added additional locks to their doors. I mentioned Ring cameras. They've added Ring cameras. And almost everyone we talked to said that they were not going to go outside after dark.
That sounds about right. And how sad is that for kids away at college? Because that's what they do. You know, they should have the time of their lives while they're doing this. Lauren, you know, the security at the sorority houses is one thing, but there's also the security at businesses where a lot of these kids and the locals, you know, are frequenting regularly. What's the security protocol? How has that changed? Are they closing earlier now, just out of worry and fear? Are they employing private security at the businesses too?
Well, Ashley, I can tell you that at least one restaurant owner I talked to, he's making sure that his employees walk to their cars in pairs at the end of their shift. No one walks alone. They maybe get the help of a manager. And it is getting dark pretty early here. It gets dark around 4 p.m. this time of year. So there's a lot of darkness really early on in the day.
Lauren, thank you for doing this. Lauren Patterson joining us again. And Brian Enten is going to join us at the end of the program as well, not even the end, in just about 35, 40 minutes or so to answer all of your viewer questions as well. So, Brian, go warm up, and then we'll join you again, and we'll get a few more questions answered from you. And thank you both. Do appreciate it. Still to come, Fixed Blade, K-Bar, Rambo Style. You may have heard all of those names for the very specific knife used in the Idaho killings, but what are those knives designed for? And is there something special about the murder weapon that could actually lay a popcorn trail right to the killer? Might be surprised at what you hear. I'm going to ask an expert next. Welcome back. In the 15 days since those four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death, the police say that they've collected 113 pieces of evidence from that house. But it might be something that they haven't found that ends up cracking the case, and that's the murder weapon, the knife that was used to kill those kids as they slept. And while they may not have it in hand, they sure do know a lot about it. Publicly, they've called it a fixed blade, which, you know, pretty much describes every single knife that has a blade that doesn't bend. But we got more information from a local business owner who said that police asked him about a K-Bar knife. K-Bar is a company that has been making knives since 1898. It sells several large military-style knives in various shapes and sizes. Sometimes they're called Rambo knives, and that's because of the movie makers that redesigned the K-Bar to have a really scary-looking serrated edge on the top. And Sylvester Stallone's character used a version of that knife right there. You can see it in the Rambo movies. So I want to show you something specific. This is the K-Bar knife that U.S. Marines are issued. I'm going to sort of hold it up so you can see it really well. But I want you to pay specific attention to the top here. This is very smooth along the top. I can run my hand along it. It's dull. It's flat. There's no serrated edge on this. But if you took this United States Marine Corps issued knife and you added that Rambo fashionable serrated part on the top that makes it look really, really scary, that's where you would have the Hollywood looking knife. Right? And it is not 100% that that's the knife that was used in the killings. It's not 100% that the serrated edge top was what was used in the killings. It's getting a lot of traction online in the media that it was a Rambo knife, but it may not have been. It may have been something completely different. And it's very helpful to know that information in the investigation, because if the killer didn't use a run-of-the-mill kitchen knife or an extremely common hunting knife in that region, it stands to reason the police would probably have a better chance of trying to find the individual through the fingerprint of the knife. You know, that sounds weird, but I want to bring in Dave Ellis. He's an expert bladesmith. He's a dealer of world-class custom knives, and he's been called as an expert witness in multiple knife-related trials. He's also the founder of Exquisite Knives. Dave, thank you so much for being here. So one of the things I find fascinating is that the media kind of ran rampant with the Rambo-style knife because a shopkeeper led most people to believe that that's what the police were asking him if he'd sold. We're not 100% sure if that's true, but I do want to ask you this. A Rambo-style knife with the serrated edge up here is, it's sort of not functional for people who hunt and fish. It's not what they would necessarily use as a functional tool, you know, in pursuit of hunting and fishing. So it's probably more likely that a Rambo-style knife with the serrated edge is not as common as we all think up there.
Well, Ashley, I appreciate you having me. And Rambo knives have kind of taken on a generic term. Most any large wicked-looking knife has been called a Rambo knife. A K-Bar knife really is not a Rambo-type knife. The first two Rambo movie knives were made by a fellow named Jimmy Lyle, and it was based on a survivalist tool. It had a hollow handle to keep fishing gear, perhaps matches and such. And as you said, it had a saw blade top on it. A K-Bar is a totally different instrument. A K-Bar came, it was a permutation of what they called the Mark I, which was used in World War I. It was a combat knife, but it also had a set of brass knuckles built into it, so it was very unwieldy. So originally, the U.S. Marine Corps used the original K-bar. They called it the Mark One. Eventually, the Navy picked up the Mark One, but they're a totally different animal. The K-bar has a stacked leather washer. It typically has a 1095 high carbon steel blade. It also has what's known as a fuller ground into the blade to lighten it, which is that little ridge across the front and the back of the blade. So it's a clip point fighter. Yes, please.
Can I ask you this? At first, I sort of thought, well, good luck. You know, good luck finding a killer amongst thousands and thousands of people up there who are hunting and fishing all the time with these kinds of weapons, until it was described to me that Rambo-styled knives with that serrated top are not necessarily what hunters and fishermen would use. It's more like what you would pose with on Instagram. It's a fetish-style knife. It's sort of a macho thing. It's more for somebody who's kind of into knives, not so much the utilitarian aspect of the knives, which changes the profile of who might have used a Rambo-style knife to kill someone, doesn't it?
I would agree totally. A lot of them are fantasy-type knives. Overseas, there have been so many copies of the, quote, Rambo knife, end of quotes. But yes, from a functional standpoint, typically, a fisherman or a hunter is not carrying a survival tool. They may have a hatchet, they may have a saw, they may have a knife. Whereas when you look at something like a K-bar, it really is a combat-style knife. It's not a hunting knife. Sure, you could probably chop kindling with it, but it's officially made for one thing. I mean, it has the main sharp edge, and then it has what's known as a clip, which is probably the front third of the top, and that's also sharpened. It's a very violent weapon, whether in a slashing or a stabbing motion. But with a stacked leather washer, you could grip it even if your hands are sweaty or bloody. And again, to immediately call it a Rambo knife makes people jump to conclusions.
Sure.
And
of course.
The K-bar would make a lot more sense to me because, to be honest with you, growing up as a kid, I used a K-bar as a throwing knife. They threw wonderfully. You could find them in any Army, Navy surplus stores, most of the hardware stores carry them.
Very common.
It's a very common tool, and
it really hasn't changed much since the
40s.
Sure, and you can buy them for, you know, $25 sometimes online as well. Dave Ellis, thank you so much. Really appreciate your wisdom on this, and I'd like to have you back when we learn a little bit more about the murder weapon. Meantime, I want to bring
thank
in Chris Wecker,
me.
Who is the former... Yeah, my pleasure. I want to bring in Chris Wecker, who's the former assistant director of the FBI Criminal Investigations Unit. Chris, I thought of you when I learned this notion of what, Dave just called fantasy knives. There's a difference between somebody who uses a blade like this, which you actually could use, you know, hunting or fishing, or those fantasy knives that are real showy. And it made me think that would be a real boon to an investigator if a showy knife was used, because then you could go down the popcorn trail of social media and who might be showing off their fancy, scary knife and who might also have links to the victims.
Yeah, the other thing is gun shows. I mean, there's a lot of places you can get this, what was just referenced as the K-bar knife. I think I agree with him. I think the other knife, type knife, described as the Rambo knife, is a little bit harder to get your hands on. It's got a serrated edge because you use that to saw. It's a survivalist kind of knife. So, you know, there are a lot of leads here. This is one of a bunch of different types of leads they can follow up on. And I'm sure they've got a team working on this type of lead, especially the murder weapon. I'd be incredulous if they weren't checking these websites out where you can get these types of knives, or the gun shows or the gun shops or the specialty shops where you can actually put your hands on these knives. That K-bar knife is a killing knife.
Mm-hmm. If it weren't the K-bar knife, but it was more the Rambo knife with the serrated edge, that the investigators would know right away after the coroner had a look and the ME had a look. They would know the wound pattern and they would know what kind of knife they're looking for, right?
I would think so, forensically, because the Rambo knife, or what's being described as the Rambo knife, has a serrated edge on it. Again, that's for sawing things. And I would think that the fine part of the blade is in contrast to the serrated part of the blade, and you could identify that type of wound from a forensic standpoint.
Okay, I have a bunch more questions for you, but I have to fit in a break. So, Chris, can you stay with me over the break?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's when we're going to take a new look at an old prank. This is hard to look at. This is an old and cruel and grisly prank that may have been much more than that. Back in 2017, somebody left dead and mutilated coyotes at fraternity and sorority houses on this campus, and police never found out who. But two of the quadruple murder victims were members of a sorority that was targeted. Could this at all be related? That story's next. Almost 6 years before the mass murders in Moscow, Idaho, somebody played a gruesome prank on a fraternity house and three sororities. They dumped bloody and mutilated carcasses of seven coyotes. Here is a bit of the local news coverage from that incident, 2017.
The president of this fraternity says these coyote killings were pretty gruesome. The coyote's body was mangled, and he says the sorority across the street got it even worse.
He says at Pi Beta Phi, there was more blood on the doorstep, even smeared on a window.
Again, that report from 2017. Police say the animals were killed in two separate incidents, 2 weeks apart. First one was on January 20th, 2017, and the suspect was a student caught on camera at a sorority house. Police said they believed it was just a drunken dare. But the second incident didn't fit the MO of the first one, and the previous suspect was ruled out in the second one. Second time around, the carcasses were found at the houses of the Pi Kappa Phi fraternity and the Alpha Phi sorority, which would later count Kaylee Gonsalves as one of its members. And it was the carcasses were also found at the Pi Beta Phi sorority. And I know you've heard that because that's where Kaylee's best friend Maddie Mogan and Kaylee's roommate Zana Kronodal, as well as Kaylee's surviving roommate Bethany Funk, were all members. They all belonged to that sorority. Police never did get to the bottom of that incident, which is curious in light of the crime that's now transfixed Moscow. I want to bring in Gemma Gaudette. She is the host of Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio. And Chris Wecker is still with us. He's the former assistant director of the FBI. Gemma, I'm going to begin with you. What do you know about these awful coyote incidents and whether they're taking them seriously 5 years later?
So, Ashley, what I can tell you is this, is that I want to make it very clear. What happened to these animals was terrible, in particular the mutilation of the animals. But I think it's important for people to understand that in the state of Idaho, it's not illegal to shoot a coyote. In fact, I went to college in the Palouse. I went to Washington State University, 8 miles away from the University of Idaho. You see coyotes and hear coyotes all of the time. So I think there was probably a lot of opportunity for whomever did this almost 6 years ago, as a dare, as a prank gone bad, a horrible prank gone wrong. And in fact, I live in Boise, the capital, the largest city in the state of Idaho. I live about 2.5 miles from the heart of downtown. There are coyotes. You know, we're surrounded by foothills. You go hiking, there are coyotes out there. So I think it's important that people understand the context of this. With that said, our police looking back into this case almost 6 years ago, we haven't heard that they are, but I would be surprised if they hadn't looked into that to see if there was any type of connection.
Chris Wecker, that's where you come in. You know, what Gemma says is really important. It's a vast opportunity with so many of those animals. It's not illegal. But to take those animals and then put them at sorority homes and sorority houses and fraternity houses, and then take the blood and smear it on the windows and the doors, that takes it to a different level. And I'm wondering what you think police are now, what lens are they looking through when they see those crimes from back in 2017?
Well, let me expand it out a little bit in the broader context and say I hope they're looking at these types of incidents and other incidents, not just in Idaho, but, you know, in the five-state area in the entire region, not just on animals, but also homicides as well, that bear any resemblance whatsoever to this case. Second thing that comes to mind is that, you know, this is Idaho. There are a lot of hunters in Idaho, and that type of knife could very easily be carried by a hunter. A hunter would be, let's just say, comfortable with blood and using a knife like that. So, you know, those are two. One is a very broad lead. Actually, they're both very broad leads. You know, possible hunter, related cases from the region. Bundy hunted. He was a predator across about five states. And, you know, he was someone who targeted people, just like, you know, they say was done here. Although I think targeted here is much broader context than what I think they meant. So you can target somebody for 2 minutes, or you can target them for, you know, 10 days.
Right. Gemma, I want you to look on the screen if you can, because this is the first time we've had a close up of the dog bed that's on that second floor balcony out back of Maddie Mogan's room. I don't know what that is inside that dog bed, but this all sort of came to light at the same time as these coyote stories. Do you know anything more about what police found up there? They have not taken it. It was there. They certainly could see it. Photographers saw it. But do you know anything more about what that substance is in that dog bed?
You know, Ashley, I don't. And police haven't said anything, to my knowledge, at least yet, about what could be in that dog bed. And it's, you know, even with that up close picture that you just showed, I think it's hard to say, is that fur? Is it a dog toy? I mean, what is it? But again, that goes back to, do police know things that they're not sharing with the public? Again, potentially you don't want to impede that investigation, right? So we know that they're keeping certain things to themselves, but it's hard to say at this point what that could be.
Boy, I'll say, but it's curious and it's just, you know, it's disturbing as well, given all the other facts in this case. Chris Wecker, Gemma Gaudette, thank you both so much. I appreciate it, and I'll have you both back.
Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome back. We get questions every day from viewers who want to know what happened that terrible night in Idaho when four college kids were stabbed to death as they slept. And how is it that 2 weeks later, police seem to be so stumped? Here again to field some of those questions is my News Nation colleague, Brian Enten. And Brian, I want to start, if I can, with Cassandra, who asks on Twitter, has the investigation checked all of the ERs and the urgent care centers for a suspect looking for possible treatment? Also, check local pharmacies for someone buying items to cover their wounds? It's a good question.
It is a good question. I would imagine so. You know, that's something that several students brought up to me on campus today. We were talking about who the killer could possibly be, and they asked me, could this person be injured? Could they be laying low somewhere? I mean, we know this was a brutal killing, stabbing of four people, that some of those victims may have fought back. So it's certainly something very, very possible. It's a good question.
So Lindsay on Twitter asks this question, Brian. Can law enforcement say publicly that there are no suspects when in fact there really are, as a way to fool any persons of interest or suspects?
They could, and you might be able to answer this better than me, Ashley. They could. It could be an investigative tactic. I'm sure they know things that they're not telling us. Would they actually hold back something huge at the risk of really upsetting this community that is so on edge right now? I find that sort of unlikely.
Yeah, it's a really interesting prospect and a great question from Lindsay. And the truth is, police can lie. They are allowed to lie. When they're interrogating someone, they can say, your sister just told us in the other room you're the killer. And that could be a complete lie, and it's allowed. But then releasing to the public, nothing to see here, you're all fine, everything's okay, when in fact it's not true, that's not something that they're prone to do. If there is a risk to the public, they will tell the public. Otherwise, it can be a calamitous result. Okay, Angie Jones on Twitter asks this. Can you confirm if they have DNA and have they run it through CODIS and no match? CODIS is actually, I don't think it's in there, but CODIS is CODIS. It's a national database of all the criminals around the country. And, you know, if the criminals have given their DNA into that database and they strike again somewhere, the CODIS can catch them. But what do you know about the DNA collections there?
I would assume at this point, based on what we've observed with them going in and out of the house, especially early on, that they have certainly collected DNA, that it's been entered into databases. But let's not forget that this was a house where six people lived, where it was known as a party house. I heard it from all the neighbors today. Not in a really negative way. I mean, colleges have party houses, but this was one of those places. Everyone told me it was this house, and then there was a house down the block. And those were the two houses where every single weekend there were a ton of people going in and out, and there were people crowded out in the street. So you'd have to imagine there's a lot of DNA inside this house because it was so popular.
I can't imagine I'm going to guess hundreds and hundreds. of samples of DNA they're going to get from that house, not just because it was a party house, but also because there were prior tenants. All of the families may have come to visit their loved one who lived in that house at some point. It's going to be a very complicated collection and process, without question. Brian, stay where you are, because when we come back, we're going to answer the one question that really intrigued us the most today about a report that police were called to a fraternity party where Ethan and Zanna were partying the night they died. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. Welcome back. I'm still with Brian Enten. And Brian, this viewer question caught our eye. Angela wants to know about the frat party that Ethan and Zanna attended on the night of their deaths. Have a listen.
Hi, Brian. I'm Angela, and I am from Chicago. So my question is, why were the police called to the party that Ethan and Zanna were at? Do you think that this has anything to do with the crime? And if so, what? Do you think that maybe they got into a fight or that somebody was mad at them? Does anybody have any more information on this?
All right. Thank you, Angela. Appreciate that. Brian, I actually didn't know that the police had been called to that frat party. Do we know anything more about it?
We don't know much. We don't know any of the details. We know that there are reports that the police were at the frat party. It really could have been anything. It may have had nothing to do with them, with the two victims. It could have been something totally unrelated. I will tell you this, though. Going to the fraternities and sororities today, trying to get them to talk, it's not easy right now. They've been told not to talk to the media and only to talk to the police.
Not surprised. I got 40 seconds left. Megan on Twitter asks, question for you, Brian. Do you intend to request interviews with the local, state, or federal PIOs while you're there? With the journalistic respect you've come to earn, I think you would get more out of them.
Yes, we're trying. We've got some interviews set up for tomorrow. We're hoping to get new details that will really push this entire investigation ahead tomorrow. So you have to stay tuned. We'll have it tomorrow night for you, Ashley.
I knew you would have that the minute you got there. We're looking forward to that. Brian Enten, great work. Thank you for that tonight. We look forward to doing more of this tomorrow as well. And thank you all as well. I want to just let you know that Chris Cuomo is coming up next. And then on Wednesday, don't forget, a vigil is going to be held at the University of Idaho for the victims. Who's going to be in the crowd? Who will the FBI be looking at? Because you know they will be. We're going to follow that story as well with a behavioralist. And we'll see you right back here tomorrow, everyone.